So, welcome everyone, good evening. On behalf of my colleagues at TD Bank Group, I'm delighted to welcome all of you to this event that's put on by the Canadian Journalism Foundation and which we are very pleased to sponsor at TD. My name is Amy Hannon. I'm the Associate Vice President of Inclusion here at TD. And in our workplace, inclusion is not just a project or an initiative, it's an integral part of our culture. Sometimes we actually say it's part of our DNA. It's that important because we recognize that we can't be collectively, we can't be the better bank unless each and every one of us is able to show up and bring our whole selves to work and to bring our whole selves and our best selves to a place where we feel valued, respected, and supported in our individual identities. About a decade ago, TD was one of the first big organizations to launch a dedicated LGBT effort. And at the time, we were taking a bold stance. 12 years ago, we started our LGBT employee resource group and our employee pride networks. We had actually extended same-sex benefits coverage over 20 years ago to our same-sex partners of our employees, but about 8 years ago, we added coverage for sex reassignment surgery to our employee benefits package. And we also went public with our commitment. We started sponsoring pride celebrations. We started featuring same-sex couples in our advertising. Today, in 2016, as our Prime Minister says, it may not sound revolutionary now, but at the time, that kind of active support was very far from mainstream in the business world, and it took some leadership. Today, we continue to lead the charge, and we're also pleased to see that others in the business community have taken up the cause. TD now sponsors 42 Pride festivals and supports close to 100 LGBT-focused community organizations across North America. There's no doubt today things are easier than they were 10 or 20 years ago, but you don't have to look too far to see that there is still a lot of work to be done. And I'm not just talking about Georgia or North Carolina. By the way, one of the things we're very proud of is that just last week, the president and CEO of our U.S. bank joined with other CEOs in urging the governor of North Carolina to repeal the recent legislation suppressing anti-discrimination laws for the LGBT community. So you can probably tell we're very proud of our history and our stance on this issue. We also understand that TD is only a small part of a much larger movement for social change. And the media, the journalists in Canada deserve an enormous amount of credit for their role, for your role and contributions over the last two decades of, I would say, unprecedented progress for LGBT communities. You've also demonstrated leadership, but I think you will also agree that there is still work to be done. Just as our employees and our customers need to see themselves reflected in our corporate framework, our community activity, and our advertisements, the LGBT community in Canada needs to see themselves reflected in mainstream media coverage. The CJF has a long-standing reputation of working to preserve, to provoke, and enhance excellence in journalism, and this evening have organized a brilliant panel on how newsroom culture and media coverage are changing insofar as it relates to LGBT media issues. As host, just before we get started, I want to remind you that following the discussion, we invite you to join us for a reception outside the room and to continue the conversation. Once again, thank you for being here this evening. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to John Cruickshank, publisher of the Toronto Star and board chair for the CJF.
Thank Thank you, Amy. Look, let me start by thanking TD, not just for the wonderful reception to come for everyone, but this spectacular setting. We are often in humbler quarters with less extraordinary views. So this is a great opportunity to enjoy this. As you know, our organization really focuses on excellence in journalism, and in a lot of what we do in this series of talks that we've now been giving for several years is try to be reflective about what it is that we're doing as a group of professionals, to think about what baggage that we bring to work every day, and how that baggage gets reflected in our work or reflected in the way we treat each other. So I couldn't agree more with Amy. I think a tremendous amount of great work has been done over the last couple of decades, but we had a long way to come from as an industry, and frankly as a society. And there's a lot of work yet to be done. So this is our effort to help make ourselves more reflective. I'm going to say we have a tremendous panel to do that. And my role is to introduce somebody I've known for such a long time. I kind of internalized, when did I first meet Kevin Newman? Holy cow, a long time ago. I've been an admirer for such a long time. As you know, Kevin has been an anchor, but I think for a lot of us in the business, it's more the fact that he's been a journalist. He's been somebody who has broken big stories, has been out there, has put himself out there in important ways. And that's what we admire him for. He's been at CBC, at ABC, at Global, at CTV. He's almost worked in as many places as I have.
We just can't keep work.
He is now co-host and correspondent of the investigative series W5. Kevin's own son, Alex, came out about 10 years ago, and that process is documented in a recent memoir, All Out. So please join me in welcoming Kevin.
Thanks. It was actually Queen's Park. You were the dean of the Queen's Park at the time, and I was the 23-year-old kid faking it till I hopefully made it. Thank you to TD for hosting this, and especially as someone who's terrified of heights, thank you for the curtain behind me. We have a great panel here, actually. It's a great panel that's really deep in experience, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about them so you can understand after we get to the Q&A, you know, where you can direct questions on what you've heard in the next half hour or so. Kamal Al-Soleili is an associate professor at Ryerson School of Journalism, former theater critic for the Globe and Mail, but he's written for just about every quality publication in the country. Interestingly, also taught theater at a couple of Canadian universities, and not worthy in journalism, really. He has a PhD in English literature from the University of Nottingham in the UK. He's an author. He's got a new book coming out in 3 weeks called Brown, but he's the author of Intolerable, a memoir of extremes, and it's been either won or nominated for any number of distinguished literary awards. Susan Margetti is Executive Director for Radio and Audio at the CBC, previously was Senior Managing Director at CBC Toronto and the Ontario Region, and her leadership within the Corp has won numerous awards for her determination to promote diversity in her workplace. And Lauren Strapagale is a social news editor for BuzzFeed Canada, often covers issues dealing with queer issues and trans issues among Canadians. Previously worked at both posts, the Huffington Post, the National Post, Canada.com, and she recently helped edit a guide for reporters and others on how to cover and what words to use around the issues of sexual violence called The Right Words. So let's have a little introduction and applause for our panel. So we have three accomplished journalists here. It's always good to start with a personal, I guess, because that's what you do on television. So I'm going to ask the same question of everybody, just to give a sense of, I'd like to have a sense of how sexuality and sexual identity has impacted your career path, if it has at all. And Kamal, do you want to start us off with that?
I started in the gay press, so that's my first byline as a journalist was an extra. And my entry point into journalism was was through the gay press. So I can't. There's no way I could separate my career as a journalist from the gay press. Obviously, I was a theater critic, so that's kind of part of the job description in a way to be a gay man.
Yeah, but you taught theater. They just did it because you're a teacher.
And preached as well. Yes.
And Susan, what about yourself?
When I started out in the private sector, it wasn't the 60s, it was the 80s. but there very much was a culture of, you know, don't ask, don't tell. And you didn't. And when I moved to CBC, which was 1988, it was like a completely different world. It was then, and it is today. And I think that you bring who and what you are to the table in terms of the perspective. And I think that perspective has definitely affected my body of work and throughout my career. I'm sitting on my microphone here, so I don't know if that's like a good thing or bad.
CBC audio was sitting on a microphone. Did you know this? So you said there are still some people though. I don't know about the CBC, but I know of other organizations that have not come out as publicly. Does that surprise you, first of all? And do you think what do you think that's a question of?
Well, we could spend days talking about tolerance and the critical role, especially for the media, and in particular the public broadcaster, I think, has to play in terms of an informed citizenry and educating people. But, you know, it's about fear of reprisals. And
Even today,
for all the distance that we've come, I think even today there is quite some distance to go.
Lauren, do you think, was there a time where, do you think sexualities mattered to your career?
Yeah, I mean, so what was interesting for me is I came out as I was sort of getting started in the journalism industry, and as I was starting to cover queer and trans issues. So it was very personal for me, sort of fighting to get these stories into print, at the same time sort of fighting to figure out who I am and what my identity means for my career. And I think it has totally shaped the focus of my work, the things that I cover. And it's been very interesting moving from an environment like the National Post, which is a very traditional print environment, somewhere like BuzzFeed Canada, where I could pretty much fly rainbow flags all day.
did you begin in the milieu of sort of advocacy journalism? Is that why you were attracted to journalism? And has that continued through time, or is that losing some of its edge for you?
I mean, sure. I think so many people get into journalism because they have this idea they want to save the world. I mean, I hope that's why we do journalism. I still think that's why I want to do it. So yes, it was part advocacy. It was, here's an issue that needs more coverage, and that's something I can lend myself to.
So you skipped Kamal's class when he was your professor. Do you want to say your story right now?
I dropped his class 2 weeks in.
2 weeks.
That's even worse. So I know in the television side of things, I can't speak for the print side of things because I haven't worked in print newsrooms, but I know in television, I think it's fair to say there has been progress made, that there are many, many people who are on television and anchors or as broadcasters who are out. But I think it's also fair to say that you can be gay but not too gay. What do you think of that?
I did work in broadcast, maybe.
Yeah. And by that I mean, because the audience for television and because the audience for conventional television in particular, news and current affairs that we work in, tends to be older, that there is still a heightened sensitivity about how people sound, how people look, and how people act. You say that's true?
I think that is for on-air roles, but I also see that changing. You know, diversity in any kind, in all its breadth and depth, is one of the things at CBC Toronto that we were working so hard to achieve, which was to bring, two diverse hosts to our Supper Hour, which was the first major market television to have two diverse co-hosts on our Toronto television show with Anne-Marie Millerake and Dwight Drummond. I think in terms of sexual orientation, you know, we've always been here, but we've never been more visible.
And I think for sure when you are on camera, people call, for God's sake, about your hair. They call about, you know, you have too much eyeshadow on tonight, or that's the wrong color for you. So, you know, you can imagine in a society that, you know, looks at their television or any visual medium that they're going to have a response. Is that changing? I think it is. Is it acceptable? No. But you know, Kevin, you're from a TV culture. It is definitely part of the culture.
Kamal, in your time in the Globe and Mail, did you have a moment where the declaration of your sexuality became much more public in the way that a broadcaster might have to do?
No, I mean, honestly, not at all. Being at the Globe as a gay, I mean, I started as an editor and before I became a theater critic, and being gay was never ever an issue. And I'm not being, you know, it's not because I was, you know, in a beat that's seen as soft or anything, because I was. I had written about being gay for Focus, like before I became a theater critic. So I would say no, it wasn't. I felt much more self-conscious of race and ethnicity than I ever felt on sexuality. So whenever something would happen and things didn't go my way, I would never say, I wonder if it's because I was gay. That never even entered my mind. But I would say, I wonder is it because I'm sort of ethnic and come from a Muslim background. That's the first place of darkness I would go to.
That's interesting. What qualities does that kind of newsroom have that you make an assumption that prejudice against sexuality is not part of what's happening?
Well, I was privileged with most of it was on the arts pages, and that in itself kind of implied a certain, I wouldn't say bohemian necessarily, but a much more relaxed. But I suspect if I were in the business section or covering Ottawa, I may have sort of retreated into the closet, or I may have just decided that this is not necessarily relevant, or this is not, it's not something I should be announcing. Whereas the first semester, I think as a professor all the time. Now the first few weeks I was a theater critic. I wrote a review of a play at Buddy's, and it was partly about bullying. And I said, and, you know, as a gay man who was bullied as a, you know, younger, I think, and a copy editor at the Globe said, are you sure you want to say this, because, you know, she's been there at the Globe for 20 years and. This is the first time a critic of any kind sort of declared their sexuality as part of the review.
So I hear you saying that sometimes it can be beat dependent within a news organization.
I mean, listen, I don't want to out to anyone, but at least I know a couple of columnists at the Globe who are gay, but they're not out. And that's a decision that they have made, and I think that's their business.
Lauren, is acceptance age dependent? I mean, as somebody who is now working at BuzzFeed, which is a very different vibe from the National Post or Canada.com even, mm-hmm. What have you observed as you've moved from sort of larger news organizations that tend to be dominated by dudes my age to one where we're like not even welcome in the door?
There's a huge difference. Because I started at the Huffington Post, which is, you know, similar to BuzzFeed, that kind of startup feel, digital and young. I do feel like I was at Canada.com, and our team got rolled into the National Post. So one day I was like, go to the third floor, you work at the National Post now. And I do remember sort of retreating back into the closet a little bit, because I was in a very different environment. And it's not that anybody had come up to me and was like, keep the gay tone down or anything like that. It's just sort of this feeling of the culture of the newsroom isn't one that welcomes that. So it's not like I was purposely hiding myself, but I was just, I was not talking about it. Or I'd be pitching things that talked about queer people or trans people. I remember them not being received as well as they would have at other publications or somewhere like at BuzzFeed. But then switching over to BuzzFeed, yeah, I'm like 100% gay every day. It's like super gay, because that's the kind of environment that BuzzFeed has created. I mean, we have dedicated reporters and editors just to cover LGBT issues at the US and UK offices. It's the kind of environment where diversity of like whatever is so welcome, like they want to hear your viewpoints.
That's awesome. So, I mean, talking about the demographic issue then, I guess the question is, because I noticed this in my own life, that you know, my son's level of acceptance, the level of acceptance at my generation versus my parents' generation, I had to live that, you know, as we were becoming accustomed to Alex's truth. I'm wondering whether or not in your organizations, do you see acceptance of that kind of diversity growing faster than the way the demographics are changing? And by that I mean, you know, true progress isn't just the younger generation growing up and taking the positions of the older generation. True progress is that it's beating that and is going faster than that. Susan, do you find that at the CBC?
I would call this CBC, you know, a safe haven in a lot of ways. It's really a very inclusive employer. It's worked very hard. You know, it's legislated under employment equity. And just the work we've done in Toronto locally, I was asking a few people today, and they're like, Susan, it's just not an issue. It doesn't come up. We created a very diverse team at CBC Toronto locally. We're doing that now. It's been 6-7 months in my new job at the network. We're beginning to push forward even further at a network level, at a national level. But, you know, sometimes it's like you live in this world where you feel safe, where you can be yourself, where it's not an issue. It doesn't come up. It's just not important to the discussion. And then you walk out of that building and you have an incident or you have an experience and you remember that you live in this little society, in this little world that's quite inclusive, quite welcoming. I remember years ago when I was first starting out, and I was one of those people who was really pushing to do stories on AIDS in the 80s. And kept getting turned down. And the reasoning was, well, it's a gay plague, Susan. It only affects gay people, and they don't listen to us. So, you know, we don't need to tell these stories. And I would continue to push to tell those stories. We would tell those stories. I would go to the public broadcaster, and it would be just the whole level of discourse and discussion on the stories that we were told was so different. And that is the reason, actually, I made the transition. There were stories I wanted to tell that I couldn't tell where I was. But, you know, it's been a long road for sure, and a lot has changed. But there's still distance to go for sure.
What do you think as far as pace of change?
I'm not in a newsroom right now, but I have the sort of being part of the university, and I see a place like Ryerson where diversity is kind of one of the pillars of that institution. And yes, it's happening at a pace that is faster than some of the older faculty, but it's not fast enough for the students because the students are coming at it from a completely, I find it very hard to. It would be a rare thing if any of my students would say anything that are homophobic or would even think about that. And so that's in relation to the pace. But the place is also is something important because we are all here in Toronto, and it may be different in smaller communities and in smaller newspapers. And I don't want to stereotype smaller communities, but we do live in a particularly diverse city, and the city that has managed to sort of include diversity as part of its sort of overall package. But you know, having done readings in smaller communities and in smaller places, I didn't always feel very safe. Having written a memoir that is, you know, about growing up gay in the Middle East, I haven't always felt incredibly safe. And this is within Southern Ontario or Eastern Ontario. I haven't always felt that I should, after the talk, I should just walk around and mince around the streets of Kingston or something. But I always just kind of felt that I kind of, again, retreated to the closet and, you know, straight acting until I got out of there.
What about straight acting on social media? Because I know of an example at the place I work, where an anchor who's gay tweeted on Instagram a great picture of him and his boyfriend. they're ripped and they're in the swimming pool and they're having a great time. And I also know that there was some things said about that that might not have been said to me when I posted on Instagram a picture of my wife and I on the beach. Where is that, do you think? I mean, if people are willing to welcome, I mean, and I think there's an expectation now that people who are in journalism are very much more open about who they are as people. Do you see that there's a different standards when it comes to, you know, either corporate media or social media or just what the expectation is about what is acceptable for someone that represents an institution like a newspaper or a website or the CBC or the CTV, that there are different standards there when it comes to social media and your behavior?
That's interesting because I've never felt like I had to hide who I am on social media. I mean, I'm the millennial. We overshare on social media. I do put a lot of myself out online. I've never, ever felt like it will be problematic in terms of my career to do that. Sometimes I do worry in terms of, am I crossing a line into where my employer might worry that I'm becoming an activist? That was one of my concerns, especially working more traditional media, is if I'm being particularly political about LGBT issues on my Twitter, which I am often, my employer is going to think, we can't let you write about that stuff now.
Hmm. What's the policy at the CBC? Because, I mean, a good number of my friends work there, and I must say that almost in private television, I find the social media accounts of some of the anchors are more open than they are among CBC on-air people.
Yeah, there are journalistic policies in place for, very hard for millennials who want to overshare. You know, on the one hand, it's fascinating time, isn't it? Because we want people to know and understand us as people. But when you're a key journalist or working as a reporter in the field, you are expected to be, if you're on Twitter and you're on a corporate account, a CBC account, you are expected to be tweeting at a different level and in a different way, content that is reflective of our journalism. It's hard because then on the other hand, as I say, we want people to know and appreciate our
One
folks.
Of the things that you respect about Jennifer Maguire and some advice that she gave you was that it's about the audience. And the audience is changing, and their expectations of wanting to get to know the person who is their filter is changing. Mm-hmm. Do you think that kind of separation is appropriate if what we have to do as traditional journalists is gather new viewers, gather new readers, gather new people interacting with the people who are the filter? They're not as trusting of journalism unless they know you, is my presupposition.
I appreciate what you're saying. Well, I totally appreciate, and I'm the one who said that to Jennifer, actually. Jennifer actually said at my farewell locally that one thing about Susan, she said she is all about the audience. Yeah, absolutely, for sure. I come at everything in terms of the audience is changing, and we too have to change. You know, how much, I don't set journalistic policy. My job is to set the direction for public radio and to adhere to journalistic policy. And it is something for sure, as it's, you know, it's an organic living thing. It keeps evolving and changing. But for sure, we do ask our journalists to take the highest road and to present as impartial as possible. And that is a tricky place in a social media world where it's just so much more conversational and, you know, I was downtown last night and whatever. So it's a crossroads that we're at in terms of how we present on social media.
I'm interested in each of your answers to a question of self-declaration in your reporting duties and if that should ever be done. Is there ever a point where that matters? If I think back on my reporting career, I've never had to declare myself as a single white man and a straight man. The only time I've ever had to declare myself in my journalism is when I did a story on my son who is gay, because I felt wrongly correctly or incorrectly, that my audience needed to know that I came to this from a position of absolute civil rights. And it's the only time I've ever declared myself. And I wasn't sure after I did it, like, why did I have to? You know, have you self-declared, and should anybody even be self-declaring in their duties of being a reporter?
It entirely depended on the story, and whenever I've written about, say, the Muslim community or the Arab community, I've always, I mean, in case you didn't get that from the name or the picture, I've always... Well, I have, just because I felt I wanted to, some extent, bring in the insider's view into this. But on some level, I envy you that you never had to declare who you are, whereas, you know, growing up gay or racialized, it's all I knew, and I was never able to, I mean, yes, I've written about stuff that's not related to being gay and not related to being racialized, but at the moment, about everything I write seems to be about being racialized, and everything I ask to talk about is either, you know, the sexual identity or the racial identity. So it on some level, I feel like it has been a burden, and there are times when I just wish I could just write about technology and something that doesn't include having to deal with Islamophobia or homophobia or anything with phobia in it, and that's a, you know, it's a burden, but it's also a privilege because there are a lot of communities that are looking to you to represent or to say.
But I wrote about homophobia, right? And I didn't feel the need to declare, like, why is it only gay people that can write about homophobia?
Well, I should hope not. Like, right, I should exactly. hope that everyone will. Yes.
Yeah.
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 You know, years ago, I lived with a woman, proud Jamaican Canadian woman. Right at supper time, the phone rings. She answers the phone. I would not have answered the phone, but she answers the phone, and I hear not on the phone. She hangs up. And I said, what in the world was that? And she said, oh, it was a survey. And I said, what did they ask you? And she said, they asked me if I was a member of a visible minority. And I said, not on the phone. the great thing about radio, it's how you think, right? And I love radio for that. And maybe that's why I always gravitated toward radio in the very beginning, is that the beauty of it is it's intimate, it's immediate, it's portable, but it's about how you think. You are not a person of color on the radio, but how you think does take us to new places and deeper and more nuanced discussions.
So is declaration, do you think, less a part of radio self-declaration on certain issues?
I think it is. Yeah.
What do you think?
I've never felt the need to declare, like, something I've written, my sexuality or anything like that. I think declaring who I am, say, on social media has been useful in my career and for getting contacts in the community, for becoming known as a person who's safe to go to with stories concerning queer and trans people. But I do think, it's interesting they're saying that, like, on radio there's sort of no need to do it, but I think we've reached a point where it is important to state what your perspective is often.
And that's how it comes through, in perspective.
Yeah, sure, but I mean, so when you're on a radio program and you're talking, I think it's good to declare this is my background. Yes, it does come through in what you're saying, but I think as we're trying to include more diverse voices in media, I think it's good for people to step up and say, this is my perspective on something.
Do you find people are still quick to ghettoize the kinds of stories that they think you can... I mean, it sounds ridiculous to even ask the question in 2016, but do you find that? Still?
Yeah, and I think that's... and I think you sort of touched upon this a little bit, is when you are, like, the gay person in the newsroom or the woman or the black person, because in some newsrooms there is one black person, you feel this tug of... are they expecting me to write about these issues because of who I am? Am I doing it because they're expecting me to? Am I doing it because I really care about it? Am I doing it because I feel like if I don't, no one else will? You kind of get caught in this feeling of, am I being ghettoized or am I ghettoizing myself? And I don't know what the answer is still.
Kevin, I think that's one of the biggest issues right there, hiring. Hiring's absolutely critical. You have one of anything, and that's exactly where you get into that situation. I mean, it's... creating a team that actually authentically looks like the public was just on a stage a couple of weeks ago in Paris. I was talking about this very subject, remaining relevant in this changing time of changing technologies. And all of the sessions were on podcasting and, you know, Twitter and social media and technologies, without a doubt, is completely changing our industry. But what are you sending out on those technologies? What are the content choices you're making? Where do content choices come from? They come from ideas. Where do ideas come from? They come from people. Where do the ideas from the people come from? They come from their lives and their perspectives. And they bring that to the story meeting table, which is why, if you actually want to be more reflective of the changing face and voice of this country, you got to create a team that authentically reflects that makeup. If you don't have any people in your newsroom who are gay, except maybe one, all of a sudden you do get into that situation. There is now a whole body of research that you have to hit at least 30% diversity in whatever your business in order to change the culture. At the 30% mark, you stop having those conversations. So when I left CBC Toronto locally 6-7 months ago, it was 32% diverse. 8 out of 10 of the hosts were themselves diverse. The staff makeup was 32% diverse. We had 2 LGBT people in the leadership team. Diversity wasn't even a discussion anymore. Like, you just stop. You have a whole different level of discourse when you begin to change the team, and hiring is such a critical role. We're just beginning at a network level. We've gone from 2, actually, we haven't made an announcement yet, so I'm not going to go too far down this path. But I was just going to say, we've gone from 2 to soon 10 diverse hosts at the network level in 6-7 months. We are, again, beginning, embedding this right into our mission mandate to connect, reflect, and engage the nation, one person, one story, one song, one event at a time. Start right there. All your choices go up against your strategy. But if you don't fundamentally change inside, nothing fundamentally changes outside. And that's key.
But to be fair, I mean, the CBC is a federal... and you're federally also regulated, and you have that is part of the sort of the hiring practices at a federal level. But, you know, the for-profit media don't have the same obligation, and if they do it, there has to also be a business case for it for them. And I'm not saying there
can
isn't.
Can I give you the business case?
No, I'm not saying there isn't a business. Before you go. But you are also, because you are in broadcast, and broadcast is, and in general, I think broadcast is regulated, federally regulated more than.
Yeah, you know, my hiring practices, even in the private sector. Yeah.
But there's a social responsibility for the CBC, without a doubt. Its mission and mandate says it will reflect the changing face and voice of the country. I remember when that policy came out in 1991, it's policy 1.1.1. I don't remember anyone rushing out to actually do anything fundamentally differently at that time. But the business case, if you just take a show like Metro Morning and CBC Toronto 99.1, that show was number 6 in the market. It had 2 diverse people who tried to get diverse stories on the air in 2001. They were often be met with, we did that once. Nah, they're not listening to us. And when we began to change the team, we began to change the content that was on the air, the guests we were booking, the music we were playing. 2 weeks ago, Metro Morning went to number 1 for the 85th time in Toronto. And may I say, in December 2003, when it went to number 1 for its very first time, it was like the first time in CBC's history in Toronto, its largest market.
Do you believe that there's a local aspect to that, though?
I believe there's a hugely local aspect to that, but I also believe that in Canada's largest cities, I believe that our urban centers are fastest growing. We continue to be a nation of immigrants, and that the majority of Canadians live in larger cities. Also, Canada's population is aging. Immigrants are, in terms of the median age, younger If you want to continue to grow younger and more diverse audiences in our most major cities, you absolutely have to go after that. That's not local now. That's reflecting.
So given that progress, then, do you think, Kamala, as someone who started at Extra, do you think the LGBTQ press still has a reason for being? And if so, what is that?
Oh, absolutely. And let me be honest. Like, I started the gay press, but I also couldn't wait to get out of it because I didn't want to be ghettoized, because, you know, I didn't want just to be the gay writer. I mean, that's also from the point of view of the diverse person who's being hired. You don't want to think they just hired you for the diversity card, but they hired you for your talent or for your ideas. It's sad to see what happened to Extra, particularly because it went to from visible presence in the city in news boxes to digital only, and this is not a knockdown on digital only outfits, but there are stories, and there are both sort of long form and news stories that were only covered in Extra. They covered issue to do with particularly violence against sort of gay men and women, sort of the subcultures within gay culture, whether it's the sort of S&M or bear culture or drag culture, and these are all sort of anchors of our community, and I feel that with a diluted gay press, because like barely existent gay press, that we have lost a lot of those stories.
Although I was reminded during the Rob Ford thing, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, most of the newsrooms, blanket coverage, great man lying in state, terrible loss, and then it took a few tweets to remind us that he was homophobic, terribly homophobic.
Even while he was in office, it wasn't talked about. Yeah. I mean, it was. The fact that he never went to Pride came up often, his being at the cottage or whatever, when he tried to get the Pride flag taken down during the Winter Olympics. But I find generally, even today, traditional news is more eager to talk about different kinds of diversity. LGBT sometimes like falls by the wayside, especially trans issues, which is why I think when Rob Ford passed, it took a while for that angle to come around.
Like, I grew up at a time when men ran newsrooms, period, end of sentence. At CTV News, there is not a single man in a senior leadership position in the news division, and that's largely true at the CBC News as well. Why is this still a problem if women have won the right to run these news organizations, that the argument for diversity still exists?
There's just a recent study that actually suggests that mainstream white men actually benefit very little from diversity at executive level from diversity hire, whereas women and people of color are actually penalized for diversity hires or for encouraging that diversity. And there's a whole, I would be happy to tweet it out later, but
it's basically that people are happy to hear about diversity if a white man's talking about it. But I think to your point, yes, there's a lot of female leaders in the newsrooms, so that doesn't mean that they're not white and able-bodied and cisgender and straight, and that they're not embodying all the same values that the men prior to them had. Yes, it might be different, and things are obviously changing, but just because you have a woman in the position of power doesn't mean there's a fundamental change.
Even though that they have suffered the lack of diversity themselves to get to that position, that's an interesting insight.
Well, sure. I mean, I've seen studies and essays and whatever with the idea of, like, it's still, for women to be able to climb the corporate ladder, has to embody those same values that got the men there. Not that there aren't some great women leading, there's tons of them, but it's not as if corporate values have undergone this great change. They haven't.
Okay, I'm sure there's some questions. There's some great conversation here, I hope. Anybody, you can direct them, you can just throw out a question, anything, any observation that you've had. Come on. I'm always reminded of how that old habit from grade school of never sitting in the front row lasts forever. And now it's like, put up your hand and ask a question, right? Good, there you go.
I have a question. My name's Rita, and I'm a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. So this issue of diversity more broadly, it drives me nuts that we're still talking about it, and mm-hmm. we're talking about it in the sense that people don't understand that it's fundamental to the business case. So I just want to make an observation. One of the things that I've learned by speaking to people in corporate Canada, so one bank CEO in particular said to me, I never thought about this issue because it didn't really affect me. But then I realized that if we don't have proper representation in our bank, and if those people aren't paid properly, and if there's, you know, pay inequities, that's a problem. And if that same kind of trend trickles throughout Canadian society, that's a huge problem, especially for our bank, because we can't sell them, you know, mortgages and mutual funds and all the cool stuff that we want to offload on consumers if people aren't compensated properly and if there isn't, you know, proper representation in Canadian culture. So that's when I came to realize that this was important and fundamental to the business case.
So within the paradigm of his business case?
Well, I...
Somewhat.
Well, he admitted it never affected him, so why should he think that?
Right.
So I'm wondering why this is such a hard sell for mainstream media organizations. I mean, why can't people understand that if you're not telling these stories, not telling comprehensive stories about Canada, you're ignoring segments of the population that, you know, may be potential readers. And I'm wondering what it's going to take for that understanding to sink in. That basically, if you're an owner of these news organizations, your own profitability is going to be impaired. If your newsrooms don't reflect the general population, and particularly not just the newsroom, not just the journalists, but if your leadership teams don't reflect the general population, the mastheads, people who are in positions of power, I don't understand why this is so difficult, and I don't understand why people are being told, we have cutbacks, this is not a priority. I don't understand why this is a secondary issue that people think about. So I'm just wondering what you guys think it'll take to bring this to the forefront and for people to understand that it's fundamental to the business case in media.
I have two theories. One of them is that if you look at the leadership in a lot of newsrooms, it's still particularly old and white and straight and cis. And these are, many of these people simply do not care. I'm going to be honest. They don't care. They look at the idea of diversity and see it as like a nice bonus. They think, oh, it'd be nice if we could, you know, get some freelancers to talk about whatever. But don't actually go through the trouble of considering on a day-to-day editorial basis what the stories are that are important to people of backgrounds other than theirs. I think it's like as sadly simple as that a lot of the time. And I think there's also a case when you're looking, especially newspapers, a dying medium. They're really trying to hang on to their core readership, which are generally people who are older and wealthy, homeowners. If you ever look at the advertising packages for things like the Globe and the Post, they're looking at families who, you know, have a certain income, have a certain sort of class background. And if they're trying to hold on to those people, they're not looking at expanding into covering diverse people. They're trying to hold on to that core before they lose everything. So to be completely honest, I think if you're looking at traditional media, what it's going to take is actually like a full collapse of the top leadership before we see real change.
You know, I when we first started making our changes at CBC Toronto in 2001, we had a lot of research, but we brought in people from various communities and walks of life, not a head of this or a CEO of that, but just folks who were key influencers in various communities and various organizations. And I'll never forget this one woman. She said to the team that was assembled, I don't listen to you. You're old, you're white, you're male, and you're worried. I really, really objected to the worried part. No one was worried. I've done a lot of work with a lot of stations, and it's like, what gets in the way? And really, we could spend a lot of time talking about what gets in the way. But one of the things is status quo. People see loss. They don't see gain. You have to sell the gain if it's going to fundamentally change.
But I also think the collective agreements can be an impediment, that the union seniority in a lot of newsrooms protects people of my generation. And so it makes it much, much more difficult, unless I will step aside, to enact the kind of change that you want under limited budgets. So I agree with you. I mean, I love some of the stuff that's going on in the Boston Globe and some of the newspapers in the United States that are completely inverting their management structure. But they've had to go bankrupt first. They've had to get rid of their collective agreements. They've had to work as the American networks work, 100% contracts. Then they're much more flexible to enact the kind of changes in their workforce. But That hasn't happened here.
But you know, I work in a unionized environment. And when I first came in 2001, we had, okay, this was a lucky break. We had four vacancies. We hired strategically for those vacancies. We began to build a team. It's, you know, I was talking about diversity really recently, and someone said to me, well, Susan, hope you have more money. It's going to take more money. No, it's not going to take more money. It's about choices. You have a choice in terms of this guest or that guest, this subject or that subject. You know, I want to get to a place. I think we've done a fairly good job of doing and covering the LGBT community and the stories and issues. I trust my team. If there's an issue, they're on it. I want to get to a place where that guest who's gay is booked because they're an expert on hockey or childcare, where you know it's radio. You don't have to declare anything. When you begin to speak and talk from your place in this world, maybe it's part of the story, maybe it isn't. Depends on the story, depends on the issue, depends on the person, depends on the circumstance. But I want to get to that place where you're not the person coming in to talk about the gay issue. Just happen to be a gay person who's there to talk about whatever. And that's kind of the next level, the next step up. I do think our organizations, all of them, are changing. But at Ryerson recently, Lori Beckstead did a survey just a few weeks ago of media organizations. And you could see the gap. It was a measurable gap in terms of hiring around sexual orientation, around people of color, and men, women. The ratio still remains quite high in terms of men, although again that is changing, and that will change even more as more and more young women are graduating from journalistic schools. But it's part of a shift, and we're kind of midway through.
Actually, I'm going to stop, because our journalism school is predominantly women, I mean female, 80% of the population is female, and has been like that for a couple of decades, and we still haven't seen that change yet.
Yeah, because who's getting hired?
The fact that there are more, there are more women coming to journalism, it does not translate to more diversity at the hiring place, and it's something I said in an earlier somewhere else. But also the idea that always depends on the place. But the idea that sort of sabotaging the collective agreement and going contract, the idea that precarity is going to create change is also very dangerous, because precarious working environment just perpetuates the same over and over again in order to survive. So I actually believe that a collective agreement is a better place to achieve diversity than a precarious work environment.
Gentleman in the back. Yep, you. There's a microphone there if you want to go to it, but if you have a good loud voice, we don't need to. Okay.
Actually, we can't see you with the lights.
Mm-hmm. Oh, perfect.
Pretend it's radio, yeah.
Hi, my name is Amar Kumar. I run a website that helps citizens take democratic action on different national issues. And I was particularly interested in what Susan mentioned about the 30% diversity tipping point that can happen. And my question is, do you think that there should be some type of legislation, provincial or national level, to encourage diversity? And if so, what type of legislation do you think should happen? Questions for everyone.
Well, CBC being federally regulated, it does fall under the Employment Equity Act. There are four main groups in employment equity, and it's the law. Women, category called visible minorities, Aboriginal peoples, and peoples with disabilities. And you're actually measured on your achievement in those respective categories. You know, it's an ongoing process in terms of hiring and in terms of growing the team. While that's legislated, and I think legislation is important, but I don't think there are happy accidents in this world. So in addition to legislation, you have to continue to really create that culture of inclusion. And for me, I've seen it start at the bottom, I've seen it start at the top, but it takes leadership and commitment. And when you get those opportunities, taking advantage of those opportunities, you need to see the possibilities and the outcome in order to build that. Whether I worked for the CBC or not, I would have done the exact same thing. You know, it is about the audience changing. And the audience is changing in two ways. It's changing in terms of technology, and it's changing in terms of diversity. I'm asking all my guys to live and play in a digital and diverse world, because we do. And those two, it's all about the audience. Always goes back to audience with me, but those two are the fundamental core, and I do think hiring is critical.
What do you think about quotas?
I mean, if you think about, we're living in a time with the federal cabinet, people seem to accept that there was a quota, a gender quota there.
I mean, if you get to do a quota about media in Toronto, then almost 50% should be diverse, like racially diverse, because the population is of people who come from racially, identify as racially diverse. In the 2011 census, it was something like 49.1%. So if you're going to go for quota, it has to be something as high as that, if you want to be realistic. And I would actually invite everyone to look at the 2011 census. I did a lot of work on it for my book, and the face of Canada is changing. It's getting darker in a way, like a shade darker because of all the people coming from the global south. And as you said, there's a compelling business case right there, because there's untapped audience that's still, believe it or not, still likes newspapers. I mean, I was in Sri Lanka a year ago, and in Asia, and people still love the tactile and the newspaper. And it's actually to some extent it's a new and affluent community with disposable income, and increasingly so. And yet somehow mainstream media doesn't seem to think of it as worthy of their attention.
It's true. Yes.
Yes. I think, and this goes back to talking about the importance of having actual queer media, is mainstream media has gotten pretty good at responding when a terrible thing happens, when someone is subjected to homophobia or transphobia or violence, or when you have things concerning legislation. Mainstream media is on that now. Great. But it's not good at doing things that I think, well, they assume that only gay people are going to care about. For example, PrEP, which is it's a treatment used to prevent HIV in people who are negative. It's a once-a-day pill. It just got approved in Canada for that use by Health Canada, and there's barely a peep in Canadian media about it. And it's been a huge conversation in gay communities as well as even in American media, and it was just not a thing here. I think there's also a habit of the mainstream media will cover, like I said, tragedy or violence, but not the day-to-day lived experiences of LGBT people. That's one thing I think BuzzFeed does really well that I'm really grateful for, is that it has stories about LGBT people that are actually light in tone. They're just about living their everyday lives. Like they had a video series recently that was trans women and trans men just having a conversation together on video. That's great. You would never see that, like, someone else, like mainstream media, doing that, because they just assume it's a conversation their audience doesn't want to hear.
You know, one of the interesting things that I've learned, and I wrote the book, and obviously in our household we're pretty comfortable with the conversation. One of the insights that I had was I could do these book signings, and there'd be families there, and generally the families had a child that was gay or lesbian, and afterwards they'd come up and they want the book signed, but they still can't say out loud, "Hi, my son's gay. Can here's the story," right? It's like, "I have a family like yours," right? And so to me, that was a great revelation that I think our assumption is that the conversation should be comfortable, but I personally, anyway, overestimated the degree of comfort among older Canadians anyway with the conversation. And so when you're a broadcaster and you're thinking and you're looking at your demographic, I work for W5, the average age of the viewer is 72. I did a story on a gay hockey player, and there was a lot of nervousness about it. So I wish the conversation was easier to have, but I've been surprised that it's as difficult still as it is.
I think just that we're having the conversation, though, is critical to changing that.
For sure.
And you know, I was standing in someone's backyard not that long ago, two very dear friends, both the man and the woman, not married to one another, have children. And I don't know how it came around to this, because we've known one another for years, but both of them said, "Oh, boy, I'm so glad my kid's not gay. I wouldn't want my kid to, I know I'm okay with it, it's no problem, but it's just I would not want my child to be gay." And I thought, God almighty, I've known you people for years. There's some distance to go.
There's great tolerance for gay people as long as they're not too gay, which we touched upon right at the beginning of this. Like, as long as they're like straight acting, not flamboyant, they're not challenging the gender binary, they're performing sort of as a straight person that's having to like have a relationship with same sex, whatever, then that's fine, that's great. And I think that's why it was so easy to talk about marriage equality in media, because that is sort of still within the social structure of heteronormativity, whereas talking about, I mean, I think we haven't touched on as much, but trans issues are something that media is terrible at covering. Can't even get the terminology correct. So I think that challenges this sort of mainstream, nice little, like, behaving gay person character we've created is problematic. Or even talking about nudity at Pride, remember how that was a whole big thing? Like, talking about actual, like, sex when it comes to LGBT people is still kind of taboo.
Yeah, there's not a great deal of knowledge whatsoever on trans issues.
Like, none. Yeah.
I just have a question a little bit about audience assumptions and hiring, and this notion that if we hire more diversity, that things will change fairly rapidly. Because I find when I'm reading pieces in the Globe and Mail or the Star or the Post that's queer content, I'm like, great, a queer story. And there's still this divide where I'm reading it, I feel like, this is actually a filter or an interpretation for a straight audience or a straight readership to understand queer culture. So examples would be something like, hey look kids, there's this whole new identity called genderqueer, and we're gonna infiltrate it and explain it to you, where this is an identity or something that, you know, people in the queer community have known about for years. And you know, there's this still 101 level of trying to explain this culture to a mainstream audience, because the assumption is it's, you know, probably 95% heterosexual. So I'm just wondering, with the hiring of queer people, will that really change that much? Because the assumption is still going to be, you know, we have to have this filter on these stories to maybe dumb it down a bit or explain it, you know, so because people won't know what cisgender means, or that it's probably more likely to be called transgender community, not transgender community, because most people in the straight community don't have a freaking clue about any of that. So I'm just curious about the length of time it takes, even with hiring practices, for that to change within mainstream media, which my assumption is quite
old. I wonder whether or not it's what we do all the time, right? That it's like, we're going to do that with economics, we're going to do that with politics, we're going to do that with, like, we're trying to explain concepts to each other. I don't know. I'll throw that out there.
Sure, but also I feel like, because I remember working at more mainstream publications like National Post, yeah, if I use the word cisgender in a story, I felt the need to explain what that meant. Or if someone using they and them pronouns, I felt the need to explain this word is appearing in the story. Whereas now at BuzzFeed, where I have an audience that I can assume gets that, I don't have to explain it. That's new and exciting and wonderful. And I think hiring will, yes, part of it, but I think it's also there is a generation gap there. I remember seeing a study, I think it was in the UK, of young people, and something like almost 50% didn't identify as exclusively heterosexual, whether it meant like pansexual or queer, whatever, just not 100% straight. There seems to be a generation kind of a people where if you tell them, hi, I'm queer or I'm genderqueer or non-binary or whatever, they're like, cool, done. And that doesn't exist for older generations.
We just want a Gracie for... I guess they're handed out in June, for the story of a man who went to his wife after 40 years and said, help me, I want to become a woman. And really, it's her story and the beauty in that relationship of what happened and what they went through together. And they stayed together. Point being that the first person storytelling removes that filter. When you're hearing from the principals in the story, it's a very powerful piece. I actually don't remember much of any narration. So, you know, just, yes, it does make a difference. It makes a difference, it's an ideas business, it makes a difference right at the idea stage. It makes a difference in terms of the nuance and the understanding of the story. It makes a difference in terms of discussing next steps and how best to tell that story. And sometimes the most powerful way, certainly in the medium I'm in, radio, to tell that story is just to give voice to those people. Anyway, it's very powerful, and if you get a chance to check it out, I think The Current will be both playing it back and will be posting it on their site in June when it picks up the Gracie. But very, very powerful radio. First-person storytelling removes the filter.
Yes.
This might be slightly mean, but we've been talking about the issue of how diverse Toronto is and how we should be representing diversity. There's a substantial minority of people in the city who are getting their news not from CBC or the Globe or even BuzzFeed, but from newspapers and electronic media in other languages, Farsi, Punjabi, Cantonese. Do you have any sense of how this issue of the hiring, the rest of it, is playing out in the ethnic press? Because the ethnic press is a major player in Toronto.
Across Canada, actually.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, that's true.
I don't. So there you go.
I assume they hire ethnic people who speak the language.
So it's a beginning.
Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of hiring, language issues is increasingly important when you're building a team. It wasn't, I think it was 2003 when young Cecilia Jang went missing. She was kidnapped from her bedroom while she slept, and we were given access to her parents, who broke their silence, under one condition, that we would do the interview in Mandarin. And because we had someone on our team who spoke Mandarin and Cantonese, we were able to get that interview, but it was a very powerful piece. It was like some extraordinary length, like it was 12 minutes long, all in Mandarin. And you can hear the emotion in the mother's voice and the power of that story. Language skills are increasingly important in all our newsrooms and not just ethnic press if we want to create teams that are reflective of our communities.
We do underestimate the size of that audience. I used to anchor Global National, and Global National has a Cantonese version of its newscast, and that's simply about taking the same resources to make something in English that you can then make in another language, and that's just scalability of a business, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes there's a lot of organizations that assume the audience is English speaking when, you know, there's still money to be made repurposing the same content across languages. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Stefan, and I'm the founder of a recruiting and consulting company that focuses on diversity. And I wanted to get the opinion of the panel around these conversations of identity. One of the things that wasn't brought up is how a lot of straight white men do talk about identity, just in very subtle ways. So where a gay person might actually have to say, I'm gay, a straight person will just have pictures of their wife and kids on their desk. So in moving forward in this conversation, when do you think this step should come in, or should it, that we start looking back to those older straight white men and helping them learn that them talking about identity is part of this broader conversation, and it doesn't just have to be them sitting back going, why do all these LGBT people talk about being LGBT all the time? I don't talk about my identity.
I suspect it's generational. I'm not sure that white guys have that conversation at a certain age. I don't know.
I think one thing that's interesting is when I was sort of debating about like coming out in the newsroom, like how to do? What do I talk about? I'm dating ladies, whatever. part of it was like I started convincing myself like it doesn't matter. You don't have to say anything. No one else is saying anything. But then you start realizing like my coworker just talked about going on a date last night, or talked about their girlfriend or their husband. It's part of just like banter among people, and yet people talk about their identities all the time. It's just when you're gay, for example, it feels like it's like a very loaded identity.
Yeah, I know my son doesn't have any problem with it in his workplace, but he's in advertising, and it's a different kind of a diversity in advertising, certainly. So, I don't know. It depends on whether you're in a creative business, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it depends if you're your age. I'm trying to think of the last time, and maybe just because my friend group, you know, knows my son's gay, that they self-filter, but I can't remember a conversation like that in my circle. But maybe that's just because my circle is special, I don't know.
We're seeing a rise in sort of men's rights groups and to some extent, at least in parts of the US, white supremacy again. And I think that's a kind of a backlash to the inevitable backlash. I mean, it's not a sense of being threatened. I mean, a lot of the Trump supporters come from the place that they're being threatened by immigrants and being edged out of jobs by immigrants who undercut and accept lower. I mean, diversity in general should really mean multiple voices, not just racial or sexual diversity, but everybody and his age and his geographic and his class and social income. And that's if you really want to create a diverse place, you don't just tick two boxes on the diversity checklist.
Yes.
I wonder, what are you doing as journalists, as the media, to stop the cliches and the stereotypes of the gay community? Like we were kidding here, and we all kid about like being gay or being very gay, being a lesbian or being very lesbian. What we really mean is how masculine you are as a man or how feminine you are as a man or how masculine you are as a woman or how feminine you are as a woman, because that really affects in the regular life. I'm a gay man and I'm average and just going to work, for example, like these organizations, sometimes they hire people who are very, very gay, as we are saying, because it's the way that people will see that they are filling out the quota for having diversity. But there are many other people, like most average gay and lesbian people, who are normal people, who are not qualified for how feminine or masculine are, and they cannot fill out that. And I think the media has a big, big voice to change that. So I wonder how are you, or what are you doing to change that?
Well, I'm glad you're talking about the idea of like masculinity and femininity. So I think one thing media still does is it really enforces the idea of a gender binary in general, and so much of homophobia, I think, is hatred at people based on the fact that you're not performing as male or female the way that you're expected to. So I think one thing that I've been very mindful of and trying to do is to get away from the gender binary altogether. For example, if I'm writing a piece about abortion access or menstruation, like the tampon tax, for example, don't say women, say people who have periods, people who have babies, because there are, of course, trans men who have periods. Or if I'm interviewing a subject, I ask what their pronouns are, even if I think it might be obvious. Just ask, do you prefer he or her or them, and respect their choices. I think that's just a small thing that everybody can be doing.
I think in my reporting recently, because my audience is older, what I've been trying to do is play people off their own biases. So, for instance, when I did that feature on the hockey player, I used every sort of masculine stereotype hockey player, tall guy. All the guys in his team are saying he's an awesome guy, and then the viewer finds out after the fact that the kid's gay, after they fall in love with him. Basically, and it's sort of like the Rock Hudson thing, right? Or Caitlyn Jenner. It's like you have to know the person before almost, and then that helps you get over that hump. And I mean, it's not the way that I would fashion it if I was talking to myself or people that I know, but I've tried to have that moment where it's like, oh, because all of a sudden they're challenged with what their preconceived notions were, if that makes any sense.
I always say
If we do our jobs really well, we can make people think, if not differently, more deeply. And I think helping people understand is the first step forward, hugely. And so that's, you know, the choices that we make every day and the stories we tell and the portrayal of those stories. That is the new normal, the authentic portrayal of. And of course, within any community, there's a range and all kinds of different types of people. You need to present that in order to help people understand. And that's a key. You know, years and years ago, I was in Halifax, and I did a story. There was a particular issue at the time. I kept hearing these rumors that if you were young and black, you weren't welcome in the downtown bars and nightclubs. Anyway, the station I was at wouldn't tell the story. Went to CBC, took some time, hired a young cub reporter named Jean Carter, who would go on to be the assignment editor at CBC Toronto News. And she went into the community and started documenting some of these cases. But the real moment would come when one of the bar owners would say on tape, yeah, there's a problem with racism in the city of Halifax, but it's not me. My white patrons don't want to share the dance floor with black people. So we weed them out at the door. You know, I remember when we were changing CBC Toronto in 2001, and people would still call then. People don't call now. They email you or text you or whatever. But people would call, and they would say, you know, get those accents off the air. We're not listening anymore. And part of what we did, you know, in telling that story, and part of what we did in changing our airwaves to be more reflective is educating your public too, right? And that's what begins to create and generate that sort of societal change that you're talking about.
Well, do you agree that there's that part of the role of the media is it to educate?
I don't think education is the only thing, but there it is part of it. I should hope that there's value. I mean, coming from the arts coverage is also value in entertainment and enjoyment. But I think all of this really to me is that we are a country in flux in a way with our demographics, and we're a country that is going through change, and the change is happening at a rapid pace at the moment because the technology is helping that, immigration is changing, and all these questions, I mean, they are not going to be sorted out tonight, they're not going to be sorted out next year. I mean, it is really a demographic revolution in a way. That's the backdrop of everything we're talking about today.
That's a pretty good way to end, I think, is unless anybody has anything urgent.
The kicker.
The yeah? Kicker, yes.
The closer.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Good evening. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. On behalf of the CJF, I'd like to thank our panel for their candor and their insights into the evolution of LGBT coverage and for sharing their experiences on changing newsroom culture. And our thanks to Kevin Newman for leading tonight's talk. You bring so much to this and made it a discussion we can all benefit from. Please join me in another round of appreciation for our speakers. Before we head into the cocktail reception, I'd like to preview some of our upcoming CJF J-Talks. We hope you'll join us, and you can have a look at our slides. On May 5th, Richard Gingras, head of Google News, is with us in conversation with Globe and Mail's David Walmsley on the sometimes fraught relationship between the tech giant and the news media. And if you don't get your fill of David Walmsley on May 5th, he's back on May 19th in conversation with Amy Goodman, award-winning investigative journalist and host of Democracy Now! They'll be talking about the U.S. election, America's role in international conflicts, and running an independent news show for the last 20 years. On May 26th, we explore disruption and the intersection of news and technology with digital pioneer Emily Bell in conversation with the Boston Globe's David Skok. And on June 16th, we're celebrating outstanding Canadian journalistic achievement at the CJF's annual awards gala. Along with our awards and fellowships, we'll pay tribute to Power Media couple Sir Harold Evans and Tina Brown. As well, we're joined by the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning Spotlight team, who'll accept a special citation for their fearless journalism exposing sexual abuse and cover-up by the Catholic Church in Boston. So thanks to all of you for supporting CJF J-Talks. You can find details about these events on our website and Twitter feed. And finally, our thanks to TD on behalf of the Foundation, not just for this terrific space this evening, but for leading conversations around inclusion and diversity and social change. So thank you, and I would like to now invite you to meet our panel and join us for a cocktail reception and continue the conversation in the next room. Thanks so much.